This is Beyond Species, a podcast exploring issues around speciesism and the struggle to dismantle it. From Elliot. Based in London, UK, Elliot rescues non-human animals that need assistance. He tells us about some of the complications and challenges, but also successes of rescuing and liberation. Elliot explains the importance of getting to know non-human animals as individuals, decentering humans in the struggle for animal liberation, and sharing stories of animal agency and resistance. We also hear of Elliot's vision for creating sanctuary, and how this could contribute towards collective liberation. So for this episode, unfortunately, there was a problem with the audio recording. The software recorded all of Elliot's side of the conversation, but none of mine. So in this episode, I've created some interludes to give some background to some of the questions or the way the conversation was going, to provide some context for the recording. I started off by asking Elliot how he got into rescuing.
Before I was actually vegan, I went through a really tough stage at work and a lot of responsibility was put on my shoulders. And without going too much into that side of things, I ended up going through therapy for about 2.5 years to learn when I don't have control over a situation, why I was tending to get extremely angry, not necessarily lashing out, but I would have so much internal anger. But I went to therapy for 2 years, worked it all out. And during therapy was when I actually went vegan. And as I was slowly coming to terms with like changes and different feelings and thoughts, the first ever rescue was actually, I had no idea what I was doing. I left a therapy session and was walking back to my car. And there was just a pigeon sitting next to the entrance of Marks and Spencer's that's opposite. They were very removed. They weren't moving much. Everyone, all the other pigeons around were. And then I took a close look and they had been like perfectly scalped, which is quite, at the time I didn't realize, it's quite natural in pigeons to get scalped, but it was this perfect scalping of a pigeon. And I was just like, I mean, I can't leave them. And anyway, I put them in my, they were quite big, but I put them in my like hooded jumper pocket. And I drove to a vet that I knew and said, what's going on? They checked them out and they said, look, apart from the head injury, they're absolutely fine. It's just a bit of shock. And they said, really, 2-3 weeks respite at home with food and water and they'll be fine. And a week later, I tried to release and they couldn't actually take flight. And then another, I think it was 10 days later, they flew off. And that was really that was my awakening or entry point into the idea that human beings need to look after animals. And no one had ever told me that before. I didn't know what a sanctuary was. At that time, I don't even think I really knew what even animal rescue looked like. I just saw an animal in need. I acted, and then I realized that I think I knew pretty much after that this was something that I was either destined to do or meant to do. And at the time, I was also looking for answers because that's probably one of the reasons why I was in therapy. I wasn't sure on like the angles in life and what I wanted to do. And I think that probably is a lot more poignant than at the time I realised, but it's probably been an absolute life-changing experience.
I'd never heard of pigeons being scalped before, so I asked Elliot to expand on this. Elliot also went into detail about how sometimes it's more helpful to stand back and observe a situation when you think that a non-human animal is in need and not to just jump in straight away.
With most injuries with free living animals, or I know there's a thing with the word wildlife, I personally don't have a problem, but wildlife or free living, if I say either, I'm talking about the same type of animals. It normally happens if it can be an attack from above, from a predator. It can be that they've flown into some sort of wiring, whether it's like telephone wire, and it literally takes off. Because, I mean, I'm not an expert in the physiology and biology of pigeons, but the ironically, impact injuries with birds are a lot more preferable to anything else. Impact injuries, like with any wild animal, and even I think probably sanctuary or more of the animals that we recognize as being rescue animals, as in pigs, cows, when they get the, like, if they argue and they get impact injuries, it's really a case of like TLC. It's more the bigger problems arise when you've got like a neurological issue or a disease that they can't just recover from. They absolutely need assistance. The thing with the free living animals is that it's really less about saving their life. It's about allowing them to have a chance to protect themselves. So I intervene. A lot of different wildlife protection people have lots of different views. Some are very, very happy and really are happy to pick up any bird at any given time. Personally, I try to interfere as least as possible. I really don't like the over assumption of just that animal needs us, I'm going to take them. You can get a bird that flies into your garden window and they're in shock. Like, I've had messages on social before, or a phone call, and they said, I've the birds just come into my garden, they're completely disorientated, can't fly, what do I do? And it's really just a case of putting them somewhere safe, giving them space. If you can put in water or seed if you want, but the truth is they just need 2 hours to kind of gather their thoughts again. And it's really just a case of shock. So even that bird, they probably need, I mean, they were quite, the injury was quite severe, but really they could have survived if there weren't predators. But the problem is there's so many foxes or cats around, they wouldn't have a chance to get away if they were preyed upon. So it's really less about, oh, I'm saving their life, and it's giving them a chance. It's almost like they've lost the ability to protect themselves. You give them that opportunity to have it back. And that, and if you, again, sometimes there might be cases where sometimes, especially young animals, when it's baby season, like mum will push them from a nest, and there's like a 2-3-4 day period where they learn to fend for themselves. Now, a lot of humans are very, very like trigger happy to pick them up and intervene. Now, obviously, there's always a risk in nature. There's a risk if that's them, they're fledglings. They're learning how to become an adult and fight for themselves and feed for themselves, et cetera, et cetera. I think we need to be really careful. Like, if you look at the cases in 2020, hundreds and hundreds of cases of baby birds or free, like the moment, the squirrel baby season. Once you have given your number out to enough people and then it gets around, it's literally like there'll be one day, there'll be like eight juvenile squirrels that have all been found. And in most cases, in some cases, human beings are trying to do the right thing. They're just too quick to pick them up and move them. Because there've been cases where someone's let, just a squirrel, for example, because it's more recent, where the other day I had someone who, I can't remember if the call came direct or someone messaged me, that 4 baby squirrels and one had passed away in a neighborhood. I think it was actually on someone's private street, and they wanted to remove them. And I said, just wait, if you can sit by them and watch. And about 15 minutes later, mum came, gathered up the 3 that had survived and took them back to the nest. You'd much rather have that than we take them. We have to then hand rear them. We have to then, you know, there's a lot more work to be done. And really, there's not enough people doing the work to maintain all these animals. So I think it really needs to be a lot more awareness raised for what to do, as opposed to just pick them up. Definitely, I mean, observing before acting is super important. A bit like something I always say, like listening is really important before speaking. Observing is really important before acting sometimes.
Elliot explains some more about rescuing and how these rescue situations can come about. He also explains some of the complications that can arise. He also explained what it's like to lose someone that you tried to care for, but that you can learn from tragedy and become a better carer for the non-human animals.
Wildlife protection is probably less animal rights advocates and vegans than more. I mean, whenever I've been to meetings in my early days, very few people were vegan. You get the occasional like 40-year animal rights activist, ALF type, but in general, it's people that just really want to help. With birds in particular, it seems that human beings either hate them or love them. It's kind of nowhere in the middle. Like, even people just like, even when I've picked them up, they're just like, oh my God, I can't even touch that. Like, what is that? I'm not touching them. I might get disease. And it, amazingly as well, with COVID, people were even more awkward about putting, for example, a bird in a box that needs help because, oh, they've got disease, you know, spread COVID. And it's just like, I mean, how just goes to show the level of ignorance and I don't want to say intelligence, but like the ignorance to think that that's the thing. And the overwhelming description of them as vermin, as if they do so much damage and they're so disgusting. And ironically, if we look at the damage that they do or what or who they are to the world in their habitats, I mean, human beings are much, much worse and are much more like vermin than pigeons. It's almost like we actually project our own misgivings or our own behavior onto them. But yeah, no, doing the work and being willing to read a book, listen to a podcast, or however you take on information, taking it on. Again, like I'm every single animal I've ever had come live with me, it's all been through going online, reading about it, reaching out to someone I know, having a conversation. This is the first year I've ever taken on squirrels. I've had about 7 in and out of in the last, like, I would say 2 to 3 months. And it's really sad, but you take on a new species, you tend to learn through tragedy. The harshest reality is, like, I even look at the rabbits that I would say that I have a really self-taught understanding of now. My first rabbit that I ever had live with us, before veganism or before I was an animal rights advocate or however we describe it, I lost that first rabbit to a lack of knowledge. But that lack of knowledge that we lost one to, we've probably helped 3 or 4 live because from learning from that original mistake. And I think a lot of people would probably want to enjoy the idea of helping and assisting animals. Actually, a lot of people probably, you've got to have a pretty not thick skin, but you've got to realize the rough side of it. And the rough side of it is you are going to experience a lot of loss, and it does hurt. It really does. When you hand rear, for example, perfect example of like hand rearing. I've had 2 cases this year. Earlier in the year when we were in lockdown, I decided I would start to take in some younger animals because there just wasn't enough people. People were full. So again, took the advice on and just started hand rearing young garden birds. My first one I had here, or maybe the second, 15 days into hand rearing, and got up one night to do a feed and they had just gone. That can happen. The truth is you don't know what's happened before. So I've had so many cases where there are animals you've brought in and you are like, they are absolutely fine, I'm sure they're going to be okay, and you lose them. And there are others that come in that really you think they're on their last legs, I really can't see them turning it around, and they do. And it's just, you don't know what you're taking in. And that's why I said impact injuries, like that are visible, are really they're like the ones that I go for. I'll happily take in any animal with any sort of, even if it's as opposed to superficial injuries, but just a nasty impact wound, over like, they will be so much more straightforward in general than if you take an animal in that's got clearly like some sort of neurological issue that might be through dehydration or calcium deficiency, or if it's a specific breed, maybe a lack of fiber. And then it's kind of working out what's wrong. And it's if you get to the root fast enough, I've had these conversations, when you take on the responsibility of hand rearing, it's really tough when you lose one. And especially when you don't have an explanation, you just don't know what it's from. It could be an internal injury from when you found them, and you always doubt yourself. You'll always think, oh, did I do something wrong? But it's a really huge responsibility. But again, it's why at all costs, work to not intervene. Really, they're the mothers of those animals or guardians. They're the ones that know how to do the work. We're all learning. And especially, I think Well, more because I've got more experience at the moment with the wild and free living. Everyone's got their own ideas of on what's better or who knows more, and it's quite competitive. From what I've seen, it does seem that a lot of sanctuaries compete. There are some in particular that don't actually welcome second and third opinions, which I personally have got a real problem with. But I just think we just all have to use like a wealth of knowledge from a multitude of different people. The more knowledge we can gain, the better. I mean, I know some people that would say, yep, feed that. That's what they need. And another person would say, absolutely do not feed that. That will kill them. And it's how do you, you know, how do you know who's right and wrong? But if we all take on the information, and yeah, it sounds like a really flippant way to say it, but there is a little bit of trial and error, which is again why, if we can avoid taking them away from what's natural, unless it's absolutely imperative, we really should, or at least get some advice before intervening, and don't be too quick to act, because yeah, it's really, really difficult. I said I lost the first squirrel we took in. We had for 7 or 8 days, and she just seemed to go from strength to strength. And then I was luckily enough where with my work, they let me take in young animals in carriers, because it's not, they're not loud or they're not smelly or they're not, you know, they're not a problem in an office. But went to work, done a feed in the morning, went to work. I had no signs of aspiration, which is a big killer in young squirrels, where they get pneumonia from inhaling the milk you feed them. Hadn't seen any signs of it. I honestly still to this day don't know what happened, but we lost her. I was at work. I'd fed at about 7 a.m. Went to feed at 11, and she was lifeless. She hadn't passed yet, and I tried to resuscitate. I still don't know what happened. If you don't see the signs of what's wrong, especially with prey animals, because they hide their illnesses, that's how they survive. Rabbits being like a major problem with hiding their illnesses, which is why so many die, and no one has a clue why. But it's because we have to look for the signs. But yeah, it was absolutely brutal. Like, it was really like 3 or 4 of the worst hours I've been through. And I had like salvation. I got a phone call as I laid Pippa to rest. I got a phone call, literally a phone call, as I was in the process of walking away in absolute fits of tears. I got a phone call to say, North London, there's a young squirrel that's been found in Golders Green Park on their own, covered in dirt, can you help? And it was just like, I just like completely switched, sprinted to my car and drove straight to Golders Green. And I'm like so pleased to say that, well, the 4 I've got here at the moment, they're all healthy, they're all well. What happened with Pippa, even though I don't know what actually happened, all it's done is made me even more vigilant. Just small things that I think, well, did I do that with her? Well, I'm going to do that with the newbies. And I'm going to make sure over and over again, and I'm not going to take anything for granted. Because even if you're actually not doing that, you still think, right, well, I'm going to put myself in the mindset where I did take that for granted and I need to be more vigilant. But that's the brutal reality of animal care, is you tend to learn about new species through a form of tragedy that might be a passing or it might be a close call situation. But yeah, it's not for everyone, especially wildlife protection. But yeah, that pigeon outside Marks and Spencer's was really the catalyst to always want to do more.
I asked Elliot to share with us a story of success or a time that had really uplifted him.
The one story that I'll get to in a minute would probably be Till, who is a half wild, half domestic rabbit that I'll get to in a minute, because she's a big part, I think, of where we've moved to as well and got to. I think actually I would say it's really hard, because I've probably gone to around 200-300 different cases. I tell you what, one thing that's always really nice is when you get called to a bird caught in netting. When you release a bird that's been caught in netting and at the same time destroy the net, there's always a wonderful feeling of accomplishment there. And one of the best videos you can see is when you release a bird from a net and then you release them and they just soar into the sky. And that's always really nice.
Elliot then went on to share with us some stories about the muntjac deers who he had assisted, as well as a story of Tilt. Tilt is a rabbit who he rescued from a dire situation, and Elliot explains how Tilt's story can be used in advocacy in the future.
A group messaged me and said, do you want to deal with this? We don't deal with mammals. And it's some wildlife groups can be funny like that. They don't deal with mammals. And I went there, and a muntjac deer had been hit by a car on the side of the road. I mean, they were in bad shape, but not, I didn't think life-threatening, but at the time it was the first muntjac I'd ever been called to. I'd only met one once, and the first time I'd been called there, so my knowledge isn't great, but it's just like, that. Just go over in your head the same thing. So check the injuries, check for like any sort of like fleas or flies in any of the wounds, make sure you've got saline solution, make sure you've got all the things at home that you need. And got there, and the RSPCA had already arrived. And it just by chance, I got a RSPCA officer that turned a blind eye and let me take her because she cared enough to. Brought her back here. She was here for 2 days. We cleaned up the wound, and then she went on to another rehabber who had more experience at the time, a more experienced rehabber who then took her to sanctuary about 3 weeks later. There might be a certain species that you have here and you bond with more. It's natural. You do bond with certain animals more than others. Not that the care is any different. It's just the actual, it's like the relationship you build. But she went to sanctuary, and that was like the first muntjac to have come here. She was so close to being put to sleep by the RSPCA because muntjacs, they're invasive in the UK. That's their job. As much as we hate the RSPCA, they're told to do that. That's how they act. But I got the one officer, or the one of the few officers that let me leave with her. And that was a real amazing achievement. And then the third one we had, I don't know if I would say I wasn't worried because it wasn't life-threatening. A very young muntjac had fallen into a lock. I got a phone call. Someone who had been told that there was a guy who looks after muntjacs. I mean, it isn't like a long-term thing. Someone had just seen, probably, or I'd heard through the grapevine that I had a muntjac. And we got there, and she said, look, there's a muntjac in the lock, in the canal. None of us can go in there. What should we do? And I was just like, right, let me get down there. So we went down, it wasn't a wetsuit. It was my version of a wetsuit. Pretty much got into the lock. It took about 45 minutes to get them into this corner. And then they went into the sewage system. And somehow it transpired that they got their head caught in the most awkward space imaginable. And if you ever hear a muntjac scream, it is, oh God, it goes right down your spine. But anyway, we managed to get the drain open, and we got in there, and it took me, and they actually called the fire brigade. And this guy from the fire brigade came down, and we managed to get her out. And her injuries were, oh no, do you know what? That's another one. No, so the one I was saying. So yeah, the fire brigade came. We got her out, and actually she was gone really quickly. She was fine. It was the most recent one. She was an absolute wildling, but she was here for about 2 months because her injuries were really, really severe. She had a really nasty leg wound that took a good 6 weeks to fully recover. But yeah, all of the muntjacs, they've all been like real, they've all felt like huge achievements. But Till, we had two rabbits, I think. We only had two rabbits at the time. And although we were planning on starting a sanctuary, it wasn't really in the works yet. It was a future pipeline thing. And I start, because I wanted to start seeing if maybe we could take some more on, I did a search on one of these online boot sale websites called Spock. And you can normally tell, I mean, all of them shouldn't have animals being sold on them, but they do. But you always look for the ones that used the worst language. Like literally you'll get a picture of a rabbit and it'll say, I need it gone now. And I just remember with Till, the language really troubled me. It was something along the lines of moving, need them gone now, any offer, or something like that. And like alarm bells started ringing. So I quickly got in contact with the people
managed to get their address and went round to their address, not really knowing what I was walking into. And although the people weren't like evil bastards, they really weren't. They just saw them as toys, and there was rabbits and babies everywhere. There were babies in washed out petrol cans. There were babies that had been taken from one mother and put with another. They've all got wounds because they're all attacking each other. And we managed to get them all out. I spoke to two other rescues, and all we got, it was six babies and five adults in total. And one baby passed away, but all the others are well and rehomed now. But when I went there, I looked for the most emergency, like the biggest emergency or the most worrying rabbit. And there were two rabbits together, one who had wounds on his ear and his back. There was like an obvious hole in his ear where he'd obviously been bitten by another rabbit. And then Till couldn't even stand up. She was, when rabbits get middle ear infection, it's called, or a parasite infection called E. caniculi, they lose the balance of their head, so they get a head tilt. And some rabbits live with the most severe of head tilts, but she couldn't stand. So I immediately said, I'm taking these two right now. Neither of them had been spayed or neutered. She could have been pregnant. I honestly don't know how she wasn't, but amazingly she wasn't. And I took her immediately, and it was about 4 to 6 weeks of having her propped up most of the time with towels, so that if she lost her balance, she would just roll once or twice. Because if you don't create a barrier for them, they can just roll continuously because they can't actually balance. They can't catch themselves. So it just kind of turns into this non-stop rolling around. And 4 to 6 weeks of having a really severe tilt, and we had to separate her from Rocky, who is the other male that we took. And then after, I think it was about 2.5 months, we reintroduced it. Time-wise, I might be a bit off, but something like two and a half months, we reintroduced them after they had both been vaccinated, spayed, neutered. They had both been on Panacure, which is like a dewormer, and it's a parasite killer. And I mean, even to this day, I would say only really in the last 3 months have I noticed, and this is now, they've been with us for probably 18 to 24 months. In the last few months, I've noticed that she's finally almost fully equal now. She jumps. I mean, she doesn't do all of the normal things that a rabbit would do. She's still restricted, but you see her now and she'll jump up onto a chair. I mean, at the start, to think when she couldn't stand up. So I would say she is one of those stories that I'll always tell, because, and also her background story is an indication into the problem also with, it's not just about animals that are going to be bred for food or even bred for fur. She wasn't bred for fur. She was bred to be a domestic. She was either bred to be sold, or her mother would have been wild, or her father would have been wild, and then another domestic would have either been broke, would have got out from a garden, or would have been dumped. So however it works, she is a great way to start. And I also, when we eventually do move, there'll be a lot of education on domestic animals and talking about that side of things. But she really is a product of really human apathy and human ignorance, and really just the shit of humanity, if I'm honest. So she's a great tool, if that's the right word, for education. But I'll make sure her story will be told many, many times, and I'll go into a lot more detail. I don't want to talk about her for 2 hours nonstop on this. But yeah, she'll be someone she will do amazing things, as in educative work, when people meet her in the future. And hopefully, I mean, she's such a bruiser now, she dominates everyone and anything around her. She'll be here for many, many years to come.
In the next section, Elliot speaks about agency and how non-human animals resist, and also how in the animal rights movement we seem to focus quite heavily on feeling pity for non-human animals, which actually is not helpful for them. Elliot also explains about the dynamic between the human looking after the non-human animal, and how that can be complicated due to the oppressive situation that a lot of non-human animals have been put into, and how true liberation is more complicated than simply emancipating animals from the cages.
First of all, it's a tricky one. When I've done any literature on this, someone's asked me to do something for a magazine, let's say. Even when I'm talking about this, I'm still putting them under the constraints of a human being's thought patterns and opinions. So I'm still limiting them to my own feelings, thoughts, and knowledge. So even within that, there are still murky areas. The Instagram page itself, I made that page because I didn't believe there was enough work being done to empower animals. What I've found in this movement is we are so desperate to pity them. We are so desperate to feel sorry for them. And there's no denying every single person that is an advocate for animals in any way feels sorry for them because they are put through misery. But this isn't about pity. Animals don't need to be pitied as part of their future. They need to be empowered and recognized for the agents and the abilities that they have, not what they don't have. So human beings, even those that are claiming to want to help them be free, we are still in a way making them seem like they are solely dependent on us. Now, in a way, we make it seem like it's total dependency. And a lot of people do this, and I think it's because this work hasn't been explored properly yet. But even within sanctuaries, it's this idea that they solely rely on us. We give them this, we give them that. Well, it's kind of true and it's kind of not true. It's like if the tanks are smashed, would the dolphins not swim free anyway? If the cages aren't open, would the pheasants not fly, kind of thing? If you remove the constraints around them, they will break free. Now, human assistance is... For example, if you liberate or if you rescue, for example, an animal that is due to be slaughtered, they are at a point in their lives where they've got to be completely dependent on food, water, and probably not even shelter, because really they're just put into a situation that's disgusting. If anything, they've survived this hellhole of a life they've been given in most cases. They then depend on humans, and in a weird way or in a real perverse way, a lot of human issues. We talk about slaves falling in love with their masters because of the dependency on them. They almost fall in love with the people that imprison them. And in a way, it's kind of similar. Now, to an animal, if you look at an animal that looks at, let's just say, a farmer, that they only know the harsh touch of the harsh experience of a kick or a punch or food and water. When they come out of that space and into a sanctuary, the human being might not necessarily look that different to them. So you have to build trust. And you don't build trust through making them solely dependent. You build trust through giving them freedom and supplying them with what they need. It shouldn't just be a case of, I'm the human, I do everything for you. Because yes, there are cases where some animals are in such awful situations or awful forms of health that they are dependent, and I get that, and that is when human assistance is absolutely imperative and we don't have a choice. But we shouldn't be so quick to assume that animals need humans and they are solely dependent. In a way, that's further human supremacy. There needs to be, in my opinion, or as I'm learning and doing more work, especially through learning through disability rights activists, the recognition of an interdependent like framework where they need us, especially when you do rescue work, they need us. And in a way, we need them. When you do animal rescue, you're providing them a space. There's a learning to do with the idea of us being them, with us relying on them for certain. I mean, it might even be down to it's the way we continue to stay positive.
there's so many avenues that we can go down and look at them, but they require us, we require them. They see us, we see them. They have certain desires, as do we. And I think something that we've all done in our past is we've kind of, even though we've not intentionally done it, there's a really, really popular phrase that a goat is a pig, is a cow, is a boy kind of thing. Now, although I understand the sentiment, the problem is that is the idea of grouping together a species. Now, if you work within a framework of a goat is a goat and all goats are the same, a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same, and however we want to frame that, whichever species we use, it's simply not true. Because if you take 100 of any species, 100 humans, yes, there are similarities. Of course there are. There might be two that look very similar, the same as human beings. I mean, sadly, because of human genetic modification with animals, yes, a lot of them look similar, but they're all different. You very, very, very rarely, if ever, meet two animals that are the same. Every animal that I've ever met in my life, and I've met thousands, I've never met the same animal twice that had exactly the same personality or exactly the same characteristics, or the ones that wanted to be touched exactly the same way or approached the same way. They're all different and they're all individuals. So I think we really need to remember they are individuals, and potentially some of the problems of taking on too many animals without enough, let's say, volunteers or enough observation is that they all tend to then be grouped together. Okay, we've got 100 pigs, stick them all in that field, we feed them all at the same time, and we just let them get on with it. Yes, that's a part of liberation and a part of freedom, but there's also more to do. And again, I really believe, especially with animals that have already been through a system that have forced them to be dependent on humans, I just think there's work to be done in stripping it back and individualizing them, not just grouping them together. And although it's very difficult with large sanctuaries, I'm aware of that. And I think then you have to find the balance of number of animals to number of humans. So there might be a sanctuary that has 1,000 animals and only 15 volunteers. Well, that means that there's really not enough volunteers, let's say, to observe all the animals. So then you might need to change the structure of the sanctuary or structure of the volunteer program, let's say. But the idea that we group together species and treat them all the same, and we do it within this movement, just like farmers do it to their, in inverted commas, livestock. We do that. I see it on Instagram, I see it on social media, and I hear it in people's outreach and rhetoric every single day. We don't individualize them enough. And ironically, humans that group together, marginalized groups of humans, do exactly the same thing. It is what we do. It's actually how, it's one of the key components of discrimination, is to discriminate based on a species group, and then you group them all together as the same. If you're into politics and you follow, I mean, especially American politics, you listen to I listen to a podcast every day called Democracy Now with Amy Goodman. It's a fantastic podcast. But when you hear, for example, someone like Donald Trump, the way he talks about others, that's all he does. He rarely even deviates from the idea of grouping together of people. For example, Trump just simply describes all of the BLM protests. He just describes them as thugs. If you go to one of those protests, you are a thug. You're grouped together as thugs, let's say. Or sometimes he'll use another terminology, whatever it is. But it's something humans have done to other humans, and it's something that humans now do to animals. And we might not even know that we're doing it, but we actually are in many cases. And that's not to say making a mistake and doing it means you're bad. It doesn't mean anything like that. But if someone messages you or someone says to you, look, this is a better framework, this is a better idea to give, this is a better way of potentially getting them recognized as individuals, as part of a future that's better for them, don't take it the wrong way. Swallow it and say, oh, that's really interesting, thank you for letting me know, let me look more into it, as opposed to saying, that's not what I meant, or the, I mean, you know the term, the voiceless is the one, you know, this, the the constant back and forth with the term voiceless. Well, yeah, I say voiceless, but you know, I'm talking politically. Obviously, they're not heard. They're not heard in court. And it's like, yeah, but you deny politics. So you can't then pick and choose. If you use the term voiceless, you can't tell every single person that sees you saying voiceless what you actually mean. So your intention might be one thing, but what actually happens is another. If you wear a vegan leather jacket, you meet 100 people on the street, they all know it's vegan leather. That's great. The other 1,000 people that walk past you and saw a leather jacket think it's leather. And I'm not saying don't wear a vegan leather jacket, but these are issues that are important, and they're issues that have real meaning. And there needs to be a lot of discourse around these things, because, and they do connect. They do in some ways connect to each other. But yeah, these topics, it's so easy to just go off and think, oh, it's all that. And then you think, oh, wait, you know, there's also that. And you said it's the going back to where we were before, the assumption that all animals need us to do every act for them. That's not true. If we actually think about the acts that we take on behalf or in solidarity with animals when we think we need to, it's probably less than 5% of all the percentage of acts they carry out. Every time a cow bucks when they're forced to walk to a milking parlor, a human being didn't tell them to act like that. Every time a baby is taken from a mother and she bellows out and runs after her baby, a human didn't tell her to do that. The farmer that was recently killed in Aberdeenshire by a bull on a farm, a human didn't tell that bull to do that. And I'm not saying that the bull intended to kill that farmer. Although I believe many animals take revenge when they can, I don't know if that bull meant to kill that farmer. But no one told that bull to do that. That bull, of his own free will, in his own world that he knows, decided at that moment he was going to do something. No human told him, you're going to act that way. So there are millions of cases of animal resistance every day. Since we started this convo, probably millions of cases of animal resistance that no humans know about and no human told them to do. Yeah, we might do a really important act, like someone might walk into a farm and take an animal out of suffering, okay? Take an animal out of the exploitation and put them into a better situation, I hope. But that's one act out of many. And yes, that act was part of giving them a new life and a new world, let's say. It doesn't mean that they're just solely dependent on us. It's one act. You know, that's all it is. And it's not about putting down the person that did that. Obviously not. Animal liberation is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But animal liberation is also assistance. It's not just, I'm doing this for the animal, they need me, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot more to it. And they're very, very capable. They have ability. They need certain assistance. But there isn't just a sole dependency on us to act for them. Again, I wonder whether that is actually a product of pitying. The over-pitying of animals. Oh, you know, and again, I just to be clear, I am not some cold-hearted human being that doesn't feel pain. I genuinely have cried every time I've watched something awful. Yes, I get upset, but it doesn't mean that animals need to be pitied for them to have a better future from probably when me and you are not here anymore. A proper future and a happier future and a liberated future isn't through pity. I mean, it's one of the most clear, obvious things. I think most people who think about it, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. So if that's true, why do we continue to pity them?
Next, Elliot shares his thoughts on some of the rhetoric and messaging used within the vegan/animal rights movement.
I am one for being disgusted with certain people's behaviour, but I know intention sometimes isn't as bad as what things look. But intention doesn't change the world. Intention doesn't change the lives of others, and intention doesn't get change. What does is doing the work and acting. And if we keep doing this to animals, and if we keep degrading them with the rhetoric we use or people use that they think is good, but actually harmful, how are we ever going to get this change? And someone was saying to me the other day, someone said to me, I was talking to someone and we were talking about outreach and how really minute it is as part of real change. And they said to me, I'm actually at a point now where I think because of people's entry points being with all of these outreach groups, all of these outreach groups, not all, well, I just said all, some of these outreach groups fundamentally promote the wrong types of messaging. Even if the intent's right, the actual delivery of the message isn't right. And if we get all these new people that want to join a movement to help animals and we're fundamentally degrading them through our language and rhetoric, this is probably why so many people who move out of the vegan bubble and into collective liberation and total liberation, I think it's why they probably get so disheartened. It's not actually the behavior of one or two. It's the amount of damage we believe they're probably doing to the masses, because without sounding like I know it all, because I definitely don't, the masses within animal rights, mainly veganism or plant-based lifestyle, they are impressionable youths. That's the truth. I might have been near my 30s, but I was very impressionable when I found veganism, extremely impressionable. And whenever I talk now, I talk to the person that I used to be, that I now, I'm not angry at, but I'm upset with my own entry points. So I always try and talk to the person that I used to be, to that would have made myself see the truth and myself see the reality. Because a lot of people give me a lot of grief. The truth is, I used to be those people that I now try to make change. Not, I wouldn't say I'm as offensive and as oppressive, but I've been that give animals a voice. I've been that apolitical person. I really have. And I've been the person that was like, don't cause infighting. It's going to do damage to the animals. I've been that person, and I've also been the person that got just really frustrated with people that were trying to change language. I really have. I've been that person. So I always, when I talk, and I, again, even as I talk to you now, I'm trying to talk in a way that is palatable for someone that's new, who might be open to listening, or in a way is still acting like a sponge. A lot of people get involved 6 months later, they're the opposite of a sponge. They don't need to learn more. They don't want to learn more because what they're doing is right, because they've been given the pat on the back they needed by a person that would be seen as important. But whenever I talk or whenever I converse in any way, I really try to make it palatable, because I just want people's entry points to be, even if we remove everything else, all the human issues at the moment, animal agency and animal liberation should be at the forefront of new impressionable animal rights or animal advocates. And I wasn't. It took me four or five months to learn who the ALF were after I went vegan. A long time, even to this day. I mean, maybe not now, but even probably a year ago, someone would message me and be like, oh yeah, yeah, do you see this? And I'd be like twiddling my thumbs thinking, right, shall I pretend that I know who this is, or shall I just be honest and show how ignorant I am? And it's because my entry point was modern veganism. It had nothing to do with history at all. And do you know what? Actually, I think a lot of people probably had this. I look at the Animal People documentary with the Shaq campaign. That was only about a year ago, and it was only by chance that 3 months before that aired, someone sent me something about Shaq. Now that means, and I'm not saying that everyone gets to have all information. Of course we don't. We pick and choose as well. But Shaq campaign is a really big part of the animal rights history, especially animals in labs, which is another whole podcast for how we avoid animals in labs. But 2-3 years of being an animal rights advocate, and I've got no idea about one of the most progressive, and I don't know if I'll say successful campaigns, but productive campaigns that existed in history. And I had no idea about it. So what does that say about me? What does it say about the people that introduced me to the movement? You know, so I really hope new people will start to look in the right places for information. And I honestly don't think they can look any better than an Instagram page like Agents of Liberation, where it's got nothing to do with humans. Even though humans play a part, that page is just about the agency and capabilities of animals. And I think if everyone who came into this movement if we had rules, I know we don't like rules, but if we had a rule that when you get involved into a movement that is fighting for justice of others, you actually listen and observe the voices and fight of others. I think all social justice movements would probably be a century ahead of where they are now. Observing instead of just acting, and also listening before talking. It's two things that everyone is so desperate to act and desperate to talk, but no one's got any time to take on information, however it is we do it, whether, like I said, whether or not it's a case of we're reading, we listen, whether it's Braille, however we take on information as human beings, we're not desperate to learn. We're not desperate. It's amazing. We're not desperate to learn, but we're so desperate to act. But again, I think probably what plays into that is the Instagram. It's always maybe social media influenced narcissism. We have to and want to be seen as the saviors. And when I say we, I just mean as a group. I know not everyone's like that. I personally don't think I am like that. But a big part of it is we are in some ways a collective. It's just a lot of us are doing it in very different ways. But yeah, and interesting. And to go back to what you said before as well. So yeah, I work for the animals. I talk for the animals. And ironically, the most active groups of actual frontline animal defending is never acting for them. It's acting with them. And I think about sabbing. Sabs don't do it for them. They're actually actively on the field with them, working with them and assisting them. You know, so again, it's a massive part. Well, again, I mean, for the animals is one of the most manipulated and most manipulative tools that is being used against people. It's as manipulative as when you dare to question something and you're just instantly called jealous. It's one of these phrases that have been so abused now. And there's a couple that are particularly good at using it. But for the animals is probably one of the biggest issues in what you were just talking about with the how we are actually part of the problem as opposed to being part of the solution. I think it's really, it's a harsh reality is that the, I don't want to use the word infancy because it feels really demeaning, but there's something about the movement that is so juvenile and so, I don't know what the right word is, but it's painful to look at because you see the issues, but it continues to be rolled out and pushed over and over and over again, and it's not easy to break out of it, but it's easy to learn. Like people that are full-time activists, you've got the time. Like take an hour off of Instagram and just take on some information. Like just take on some information that is out of your comfort zone. Again, but I shared a post, I put some up recently. There's two types of activists. There's those that want to remain comfortable and lifestyled, and there are those that never want to be comfortable, because to be comfortable means that you've not relaxed for too long, because everyone deserves to have shut off and to relax, but you don't allow yourself to get comfortable because you realize that the problems are as apparent now as they've ever been, ever. I mean, it's never stopped. It's never, ever stopped. And again, there's a lot to be said with that as well, where your activism, regardless of which social justice movement you're fighting within, there's this performative action. It's just this performative fad. And it's not, none of the work's ever done when it's not a fad. As soon as that one passes and another one starts, we'll jump on that one. We won't actually take in information. I'm pleased to say that I've moved away from my personal Instagram, as in I'm not so heavily invested into it. I'm really moving away from it quite heavily to focus on the Sanctuary page and the Agents page.
Elliot speaks of his plans for the Hobby Acre Sanctuary and how this could play a part in collective liberation.
So we are currently, I don't like to assume things are going to happen, but we're hopefully, with as long as if COVID stays at bay and we don't enter another lockdown like nationwide, if a couple of things that we're still waiting for mortgage wise take place, then we were likely to be moving to our first site in December, January time. We definitely want to do it before March because for anyone listening that doesn't know, or there's something in the UK called stamp duty. So when you move house, you have to pay. It's pretty much like the government robbing you blind. Oh, I shouldn't say that. It's pretty much like the government just robbing your pockets. You move house and they basically just stick a tax on you for moving. So our stamp duty could have been nearly like £28,000 just for moving. Now, because of the holiday, or it might have been a bit less, maybe 26,000. With this holiday, the stamp duty holiday till March, it drops almost 85%. So we would be able to save a lot of money by moving before next March. But yeah, if we move, the plan is we would be moved by January to the new site. Obviously in the UK, the weather is terrible in January. So we might have to wait 2-3 months before we start to actually do some infrastructure building. The property it's not huge. It's 1.5 acres, which isn't huge sanctuary land, but it's absolutely big enough to, I mean, probably have anything between 100 and 150 animals that are of the right size and need the right amount of space for that. So really, I would think we would go from anything from chickens, turkeys, and obviously some free living animals that need rehab up to probably goats and sheep. But I think whilst we both continue to be in full-time employment and we both do work together, we work about 100 hours a week, we would focus on those that we already have experience with. I think the plan is really goats and sheep. And then as we start to take them on and we start to learn about that species, we take them on, we start to gain a much broader knowledge of them. And then I think probably the next place will be a 10, 15 year place. And then with a bit of luck and the appreciation of property in value, hopefully by the time we move, we'll probably be able to move further away from London, both quit our jobs. And then as we move to the 50 plus mark of our lives, we would then be able to move away and hopefully get something a lot larger. But yeah, the initial plan is to really walk before we can run. I really want to make sure that we do this responsibly. We let it grow organically. I'm not going to push the boundaries of anything because it just won't work. Sometimes I'm too responsible for my own good, but I think in the case of sanctuary work and animal rescue, it's probably imperative that we really make sure we take this slowly and we don't put ourselves in a situation that could leave us struggling in the future. And we always said we never want to be a sanctuary that's solely dependent on other human beings to pay for everything. So we're really committed to our jobs, all being well. It wouldn't make sense for our future plans to, for example, quit jobs too early and go all in with this and just want to be a social media sanctuary that relies on donations. I always kind of think, even though I used to struggle with the idea of work and everyone else was out there doing full-time activism, I kind of treat my work as a part of my activism. I've kind of internalized that because all the money that I can take out of the system now is going to be money that I get to put back into the right places in the future. And in a way, it's kind of like my fuck you to the system. Because I went through a real stage like, oh my God, I hate work, that capitalist model, and I work to earn money and I just get by. But the truth is, if I can really see it, because what I would like to do in the future, I personally believe is the right work. And I've got lots of plans and ideas and thoughts where we want to, when we move, to start to create like an initiative where we do like volunteer programs with victims of, let's say, domestic violence and abuse, maybe orphan children or whoever it might be. I really want to kind of create a collective, the idea of collective liberation. Patrice Jones, again, you've shared the work of Patrice often. If we can create a space of liberation through solidarity, and the idea that you could create a space where people who have been through their own suffering can engage with animals who have been through their own and who found a chance at like a second chance or redemption. And if you could, I don't know, just the idea of having a space where humans that have been through their own suffering and through their own trauma to find their own their own freedom through and with animals that have found their own, I just think it would be so wonderful. Like, what an amazing thing to do. And especially with the fact that everything we do is dictated to by capitalism, by patriarchy, mainly by my group, the white man, let's say. If I could give back really to those that are the victims of the system, or even if, like I said, even if it's victims of the justice system, I just really want to create a space that is collective liberation. It's obviously going to be an animal sanctuary, that goes without saying, but just the idea that their stories through storytelling with them, and then you've got the rehabilitation of humans as well. Just, yeah, lots of ideas and lots of thoughts, but I really am hoping to create a real space that is gonna go along with the collective and total liberation, because I really believe that is what we all need to do. And as time goes on, and the more progressive work that I do, the more I feel that is how we'll achieve great, great things. The idea that people sometimes push, like, God, I wish just humans would leave, humans would destroy everything. Even if it's true, even if, yes, we are the biggest problem, you know, we have to coexist. There's always going to be a coexistence. And if I could provide a space of human and other animal coexistence in a real safe space, that would be I can't imagine it will be easy, but I would just think it would be so brilliant. And it's just not it's not done enough. I understand why, because it's a massive thing to take on. It's hard enough just with an animal sanctuary, but that's why I'm just never going to limit what we do, or I'm never going to box it, because if I'm willing to keep doing the work myself, to learn more and more about, I said, about the politics of everything, and about political is enough. Just look at the political aspects of everything. And if I can keep progressing and keep growing and keep learning progressively with others, there's no reason why the sanctuary space can't be the same. And even if for the first 5-10 years, it's a slow burner. And so I might just have to take on, you know, smaller species for the first 10 years. But if that's what I've got to do to get to the next stage, which would be cows and pigs, then that's what I have to do. And if then from there, if I have to build the foundations of a non-human or an animal safe space before I can then create a human space, because it needs one before the other. If it needs the foundations of that before I can get the foundations of that, then that's what I'll do. But I just think, yeah, it's just got to make sure that it's done properly and organically. It's so important that it's never rushed. It's always responsible, and it doesn't compromise. The safety of one can't be at the compromise of another. I think and that actually plays into another thing, especially with animal rescue work that I've seen, is that it's not the best analogy, but you know, in business with like banks and in retail, people always want to make offers to the new customers, but the ones that are already there, you're already signed up, it doesn't matter. But they'll say, oh yeah, all new people that come for insurance will give you a kickback. And I kind of think one of the problems with rescue work is we're so desperate to take in more. We don't know how to say no, or we feel too bad to say no. And then activists will behave in a way that doesn't really help the situation. Sometimes you have to be responsible and say no to protect those that are already with you. And yeah, I think, again, it's all a part of being, making sure that you always act in a way that you're not forgetting about one to save another, or you're not compromising the life of one to bring in another. Or, I mean, like, perfect examples of that is like poor security culture, liberation, let's say, and you've got an animal that's brought in that was never secure properly. The security culture was awful, and you've said yes to a space, and you've actually ended up being indicted through someone else's poor behavior. Well, you fundamentally through taking on one more could potentially cause harm to 100, 150 or 500 others. Not that it's maths, but the maths don't add up. You're risking so many, and not that one didn't matter, But that one was never done in a way. It was destined to fail. That's what it is. If you don't, everything I've just said, that's the idea. It's like fail to prepare, prepare to fail. And I just think, yeah, through everything that I've just spoken about and my feelings on how I believe a sanctuary should grow organically and learning from the success of some and the failure and the maybe not failure, but the unsuccessful issues of some, I just think, yeah, it's so, so important. You could even go down to things like quarantine. New animal comes in, have to be quarantined. Certain species have to be quarantined. It's not like, oh, every single time, you know, this is that, but every single species has got a specific something you must quarantine. And if you don't, you bring in one, it can risk the lives of 60 others. Someone has bad security culture and you work with them, the risk of one or two is the risk of 100 others. And again, this is another thing. It also plays into other issues. It plays into other forms of action we take. If everyone can be responsible and everyone can think about someone else before their own desire to be for notoriety or own desire to be seen or heard, we will move faster and forward so much quicker. If we can actually leave ourselves at the door, especially when we're advocating for others, I honestly think the entire movement would change. And that's not to say that I've not fallen into the trap. I have. I actually see myself doing it now, and I notice myself pretty quickly when I've veered off the track I wanted to be on, and I've ended up doing something that I actively tell myself not to. And that, you know, as well, I often say, I think it comes through desperation. Something has frustrated you into a feeling of desperation, and your desperation plays out in a way that you're trying to veer away from. So everyone is capable of it. And I think in a way, everyone's guilty of it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're so awful, you've made such a bad fuck up. But if we can take accountability, be responsible for all of our own actions, and when we need to apologize or when we need to hold our hands up, just do it. I could list off right now 30, 40 situations, whether it's myself or someone else, where they just didn't say sorry. And it would have taken one public apology, and whether it's public or private, I mean, I guess that doesn't necessarily matter all the time. But we could avoid so much conflict and so much aggro. And I think it's the monster Instagram's created. When we play this back and we get to this point and we think back, if Instagram wasn't such a self-promoting, narcissistic place, and it really is, I don't care what anyone tells me, even if you're on there for the right reasons, Instagram as a whole or social media as a whole is like a narcissistic's fantasy. If we can move past the need for self on social media, I think it's done so much harm that it's now replacing all the good it might have done in the past. And there are great things that have come through social media. Don't get me wrong. Like some of the things that have caught on, and even down to like BLM is the perfect example of how a hashtag turned into a global movement. But the amount of damage that's done, and I'm actually going to watch this documentary that's now doing the rounds called The Social Dilemma. A few people have sent it to me. I'm actually going to watch it this evening. But I've got a feeling after I watch it, the removal that I've had in the last few months, I've got a feeling it's probably going to want to push me to completely get rid of my own profile. And what's the one thing that vegan or plant-based advocates really try and do, or they push? Selling. They say, let's sell veganism. Let's sell the idea. We're not selling anything. We're fighting for justice. This is about justice, freedom, and liberation. It's about abolition and changing the world. It's not about selling something. And that's one of the biggest problems in the movement. It's become a selling. The whole thing is a selling tool. And it's trash. It's absolute trash. But it all relates. It all relates. Look at Open Rescue. Open Rescue has become a selling tool. I went to the ALC conference in Berkeley, America in 2019, I think it was, which is run by DXE. And although there was a couple of talks there, which that's where I saw Jonathan Dickstein talk live, and he pretty much changed my entire perception of the movement. one of the most important parts of my life as an animal rights advocate. So I'm pleased I went. But I saw DxE for who they are. They're a theatre company, and they might do some actions that do some things that might be seen as great. I saw them use liberated animals as props to gain favour and gain money. It's like Open Rescue has become a selling tool. Again, that has got nothing to do with animal liberation. That has got nothing to do with the term liberation. And I think, again, most people need to really understand what true liberation means. True liberation, again, like another thing online where people will kind of do, they'll do negotiated rescue and then they'll call it liberation. Negotiated rescue isn't liberation. Negotiated rescue is commodifying someone to save someone. By negotiating with lives, you fundamentally commodify them. You agree to walk away from 300 to save 5. I'm not saying in the same position I wouldn't do the same, but it isn't liberation. It's negotiated rescue. And fundamentally, it's part of the problem. Although I'm not knocking anyone who's done that, if you've managed to get lives out or if it has been a tactic whilst part of a bigger plan, listen, like, I applaud you. But let's call it what it is and let's be real. Let's not pull the rug from under people and pretend it's something it's not. Animal liberation or liberation is the liberation in its truest form of others. And that is not through negotiating for their lives. That is the taking of one from somewhere that is exploitation and putting them to another, which is freedom. That's real liberation. We'll be right back.